We are starting this deep dive right in San Francisco. The date is June 15, 2019. I want you to picture the absolute elite of the tech world. They are all gathered in this glittering room for the Association for Computing Machinery ceremony.
Right, and this is an event funded by Google, so you can imagine the scale.
Oh, totally. And they are preparing to hand out a $1 million prize. Because today's deep dive is an exploration of Chapter 10, Turing Award, Glory and Priority, from our source text on the deep learning revolution. And stepping onto that stage are three men, Yann LeCun, Geoffrey Hinton, and Yoshua Bengio.
The big three.
Yeah, they are literally being crowned the fathers of the deep learning revolution, receiving this Turing Award, which is, basically the computing equivalent of the Nobel Prize.
It is the absolute pinnacle. I mean, the official citation for the award was pretty brief, but it carried massive implications. It basically said they had achieved the conceptual and engineering breakthroughs that made deep neural networks a critical component of computing.
But there is this massive contrast, right, between the triumphant, million-dollar spotlight of that room and the actual reality of their careers, because this ceremony hides decades where these three men were treated as total academic outcasts.
Oh, without a doubt.
And even more dramatically, this exact moment of victory is about to spark a really bitter, highly public war over who actually invented the AI technologies that are shaping our daily lives right now.
Yeah, and to really understand the tension simmering underneath that ceremony, you have to understand the wilderness these three men navigated just to get there. Because AI research didn't just progress in a straight upward line, it endured two very long, very brutal winters.
The AI winters.
Exactly. The first freeze hit in 1969 when early rudimentary neural networks failed to live up to the massive hype and the funding just vanished. And then the second winter hit in the mid-90s when other statistical methods like support vector machines just completely took over academia.
So studying neural networks during those winters wasn't just like slightly unpopular, it was actual career suicide.
Total career suicide.
You really have to picture the environment. If you submitted a paper on neural networks to a top-tier journal back then, it was sent back almost automatically. If you asked for a grant to fund your lab, the money just went to someone working on completely different mathematical models.
And that level of isolation, it destroys most research efforts. I mean, people just give up. Yet, through those decades, LeCun, Hinton, and Bengio formed what was jokingly referred to as the deep learning conspiracy.
I love that.
Right. And with some crucial, really quiet backing from the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, or CIFAR, they just managed to keep the entire discipline on life support. They read each other's rejected papers, they swapped ideas, and they just fundamentally refused to let the concept die.
Well, let's actually unpack this because getting a $1 million prize implies you built something monumental. So, what did each of these three actually bring to the table? Because they didn't just write a single paper together, they each built distinct pillars of the AI we use today.
Yeah, let's start with Geoffrey Hinton. So his major breakthrough came in 1986 when he co-authored a paper proving that a technique called backpropagation could allow neural networks to find useful internal representations all on their own.
Okay, wait, backpropagation. That is a term that gets thrown around a lot.
Yeah.
But what is it actually doing inside the machine?
So think of a neural network trying to learn to recognize a cat. At first, it guesses completely randomly and gets it wrong. Backpropagation is basically the mathematical method of calculating exactly how wrong that guess was and then sending a signal backward through every single layer of the network to adjust the internal weights.
It sounds a bit like an assembly line.
How do you mean?
Like if a car comes off the line with the steering wheel on backward, backpropagation is the manager walking backward down the factory floor, finding the exact worker who made the mistake, and retraining them so it doesn't happen next time.
That is actually a brilliant way to visualize it. Yes. And Hinton proved this method actually scaled. And then later in 2006, he pioneered a way to train deep networks layer by layer, which really brought them back from the academic dead. And crucially, he mentored the creators of AlexNet.
Oh, AlexNet, that was huge.
Right. That was the neural network that shocked the world in 2012 by just absolutely dominating a major image recognition competition.
Okay, so that's Hinton. Then we have Yoshua Bengio, who took a slightly different path, right? He stayed purely in academia, founding the Mila Institute in Montreal.
Yeah, and Bengio focused heavily on architecture and language. In 2003, he pioneered word embeddings, and this was a radical shift, honestly. Instead of treating words as isolated symbols, he proposed turning words into mathematical vectors.
So, like mapping them out geographically, like placing the words king and queen close together in a mathematical space so the computer understands they're related.
Precisely. That geographic mapping is the literal seed for how AI understands context in human language today. And then in 2014, his lab also created the early attention mechanisms that eventually paved the way for modern translation software. They also created Jane's generative adversarial networks.
Which are the engine behind modern photorealistic image generation, right?
Exactly. Which brings us to the third laureate, Jan LeCun. His approach was just fascinated by biology. Specifically, how living things actually see. So he used that biological inspiration to create convolutional neural networks, or CNNs.
So how does a CNN see differently than an older program?
Well, LeCun realized that when you look at an image, you don't process every single pixel simultaneously in isolation. You look for edges, then shapes, then objects. So his CNNs operate like a tiny sliding window passing over an image, capturing local patterns and pooling them together.
This wasn't just theoretical. I mean, if you ever deposited a paper check at an ATM in the late 1990s, LeCun's code was the invisible ghost in the machine reading your handwriting.
Yes, it was everywhere.
By 1989, his networks could read handwritten zip codes. Within a decade, they were processing a massive percentage of all the paper checks in the United States.
So, when you step back and look at those three pillars, Hinton's assembly line of learning, Bengio's structural mapping of language, and LeCun's sliding window of visual processing, you are literally looking at the entire skeleton of modern artificial intelligence.
It really feels like watching an indie band that played in empty, freezing garages for 30 years. Like every record label told them their sound was a dead end. And then, literally overnight, the culture shifts and they sell out global stadiums. The Turing Award was basically the computing industry finally handing them their Lifetime Achievement Award.
That is a very fitting comparison. And on that stage in San Francisco, the three of them were incredibly careful to remain humble. They explicitly credited the broader scientific community, noting that deep learning wasn't the single lightning bolt invention, but more of a grueling relay race across generations of researchers.
But, here is the problem with a spotlight as bright as the Turing Award. It casts a very long shadow. And someone standing in that shadow was about to speak up, and they were bringing receipts.
Yeah, they really were. To hear that voice, we have to travel from that glittering stage in California to a rather isolated research institute in Lugano, Switzerland, the IDSIA. This is where we find Jürgen Schmidhuber.
And it is crucial to establish right away that Schmidhuber is not some internet troll or a fringe critic. His credibility in this specific field is towering.
Towering and completely foundational. I mean, in 1997, Schmidhuber and his student Sepp Hochreiter created something called long short-term memory, or LSTM.
Okay, what did LSTM actually solve?
Well, before LSTM, neural networks suffered from terrible amnesia. As data passed through the different layers of a network over time, the signal would simply vanish or explode. The network couldn't remember the beginning of a sentence by the time it reached the end.
Oh, so it was basically a goldfish. How did LSTM fix that?
It introduced a system of microscopic gates, specifically a forget gate. It acted kind of like a smart notebook. The network could mathematically decide, hey, I should erase this irrelevant information from yesterday, but I need to hold on to this crucial piece of context for tomorrow. And for a long time, LSTM was the absolute gold standard for speech recognition and translation.
So if you ever use the early versions of Google Translate, or if you talk to Apple Siri, you were heavily relying on the architecture created in Schmidhuber's Swiss lab. This
Exactly.
is a man who knows intimately what it takes to build world-changing AI.
Which is exactly why the manifesto he published in June 2020 sent such shockwaves through the community. Because it was this meticulous, highly detailed critique of the Turing Award being given exclusively to Bengio, Hinton, and LeCun.
He essentially drafted a historical indictment, right?
He really did. He argued that the Turing winners were basically taking credit for concepts that had actually been pioneered decades earlier by forgotten scientists.
So who was he pointing to?
Well, he brought out names that the mainstream narrative had entirely ignored. He pointed out that back in 1965 in the Soviet Union, a scientist named Alexei Afanenko was already drawing up deep learning networks.
Wait, 1965, they barely had computers that took up whole rooms and ran on punch cards back then. How are they
Yeah.
doing deep learning?
They were doing the math, and that was Schmidhuber's point. The theoretical framework existed. And he didn't stop there. He noted that the mathematics for backpropagation, that very assembly line concept Hinton popularized, were laid out in Finland in 1970 by Seppo Lenanma.
Wow, 1970.
Yeah, and the roots of stochastic gradient descent, which is the method of how networks learn from errors, were developed by Shinichi Amari in Japan in the 1960s.
So Schmidhuber is pointing at this map of the world, the USSR, Finland, Japan, and saying, look at these names. They are forgotten because of geography, language barriers, and the Iron Curtain, not because their science was lesser.
Exactly. He strongly advanced the philosophy that science should reward the person who first invents a concept, the person who writes down the math, regardless of whether they were the ones who made it famous or popular decades later.
Okay, but let me stop you there, though, because I really struggle with this. Sketching an idea on a chalkboard in 1965 Soviet Russia, when you have absolutely zero data and no processing power to actually run it, that is not the same as making it work in 2012.
It's definitely a different skill set.
Right. Like, doesn't the backbreaking engineering required to execute the idea count for something? I mean, drawing a blueprint of a rocket isn't the same thing as actually landing on the moon.
That tension right there, the blueprint versus the moon landing, that is the exact philosophical divide at the heart of this conflict. Does science reward the inventor who first conceptualizes the theory, or the executor who bridges the massive punishing gap between theory and reality?
Because Ivakhnenko had no data.
None. While Hinton, Bengio, and LeCun spent 30 years doing the grueling trial and error labor to make those theoretical blueprints actually function in a messy world.
And this philosophical divide didn't just stay neatly contained in academic papers. It spilled out into a highly dramatic public confrontation. Let's look at Barcelona, December 2016.
Oh, this is legendary in AI circles. So we are at a major AI conference. Ian Goodfellow, who is this brilliant young researcher, is on stage presenting generative adversarial networks, or GANs. As we mentioned, this technology came out of Bengio's lab, and Jan LeCun had publicly called GANs the coolest idea in machine learning in 20 years.
High praise. So Goodfellow is mid-presentation explaining this revolutionary concept, and suddenly a man in the audience grabs a microphone.
Yep. It's Schmidhuber.
He interrupts the presentation in front of the entire conference, claiming that GANs are essentially just a rebranded version of a concept he published in the 1990s called predictability minimization.
The entire room just froze. It quickly became known online as the deep learning drama. Goodfellow defended his work right there on stage.
But what is the actual technical difference between the two? Was Schmidhuber right?
Well, Goodfellow pointed out that they had fundamentally different end goals. Predictability minimization was primarily about data compression, trying to find parts of the data that are hard to predict to make representations less redundant.
Okay, and how are GANs different?
GANs operate more like a counterfeiter and a detective. You have a generator creating fake images from random noise and a discriminator trying to catch the fakes. The goal of GANs is to generate entirely novel, highly realistic data, not just compress existing data.
Got it.
And later, Goodfellow did update his paper to cite Schmidhuber's work, but he very carefully noted those severe architectural differences.
But this incident kind of ripped the lid off a much bigger, more systemic issue, right? The extreme fragility and the politics of academic citations.
Yes. Schmidhuber basically diagnosed modern academic citations as a bubble. He actually drew a direct comparison to the 2008 financial crisis, where banks traded toxic assets back and forth to artificially inflate their value. Yeah, in his view, the modern AI community was doing the exact same thing with citations. He accused researchers of only citing their close friends and colleagues, artificially inflating each other's authority and visibility while completely ignoring the older foundational texts.
I mean, if we think about that, Schmidhuber is basically saying the academic citation system is like a high school popularity contest where the rich kids only vote for each other.
Exactly.
But the sheer irony here is staggering.
Mm-hmm.
His method of protesting this rigged, superficial system is to grab a microphone at a conference and loudly demand that his own name be added to the ballots.
Yeah, that paradox certainly didn't escape his peers. While some researchers quietly agreed with his historical dates regarding the Soviet and Finnish papers, his aggressive public methods alienated a lot of people.
Which led to LeCun stepping in.
Right. Eventually, Jan LeCun issued a fierce, highly publicized rebuttal in the New York Times. He flatly stated that Schmidhuber was pathologically obsessed with credit and constantly claimed ownership of things he simply didn't deserve.
Pathologically obsessed. Those are absolute fighting words in academia.
They really are. But for LeCun, this wasn't just about winning a petty argument against Schmidhuber. The deeper truth is that LeCun was just exhausted by these endless, highly subjective battles over who published what first. He realized the entire academic system of hoarding credit, chasing citations, and locking ideas behind patents was just fundamentally broken.
And his solution to that broken system is fascinating because it comes directly from his personal identity as a maker. To really grasp this, we need to do another quick flashback. So we're in Paris, 1987.
LeCun is defending his PhD.
And he walks into the room for his defense on crutches. Why is he on crutches? Because he had just broken his ankle riding a wind-powered sand yacht that he built with his own two hands on the beach. And sitting right there in the examiner's chair is Geoffrey Hinton.
That is just such a perfect story, because that single image tells you everything you need to know about Jan LeCun's worldview. He is an engineer down to his bones, a tinkerer. He grew up building model airplanes. He is someone who fundamentally values making a machine fly over writing the perfect, pristine, theoretical paper about aerodynamics.
So how does a guy who literally builds a sand yacht, breaks his ankle testing it, and limps into his PhD defense apply that same just build it and go fast energy to dismantling a toxic academic turf war?
By entirely shifting the paradigm of how research is shared. See, early in his career at Bell Labs, LeCun watched his pioneering patents for convolutional neural networks just get buried in corporate filing cabinets.
Oh, that has to hurt.
It was incredibly frustrating. And that deep frustration, combined with the bitter priority wars with people like Schmidt Huber, led him to a radical answer: open source.
Just stop fighting over who owns it and give it all away.
That is the core of it. If you put all your code, all your data, and all your neural network weights into a public repository, the timestamp is permanent. The math is right there for everyone on the internet to see and test.
The receipts are baked in.
Exactly. The endless, exhausting arguments over who thought of what first simply vanish. Discovery stops being about hoarding credit in a closed journal and becomes a massive, collaborative, transparent ledger.
It turns out radical transparency is actually the ultimate defense against priority claims.
Right.
But, you know, this philosophy of open source isn't just a quirky personal habit of LeCun's. It actually connects deeply to his roots. And it brings us to a massive geopolitical shift happening right now.
Yes, because despite spending 30 years living in the United States, working for American universities and American mega corporations, LeCun views himself as an immigrant, a scientist, and deeply, fundamentally French.
And France has welcomed him back not just as a scientist, but as a national intellectual hero. In 2015, he was invited to the Collège de France, which is the absolute pinnacle of French intellectual life.
Yeah.
But the real high water mark happened very recently, December 6, 2023.
Inside the Élysée Palace in Paris,
right.
French President Emmanuel Macron pinned the Légion d'honneur, which is the highest order of merit in France, established by Napoleon, onto Jan LeCun's chest.
I mean, think about that for a second. Why did France give their highest military and civil honor to a scientist who spent his entire professional career in America? It wasn't just a lifetime achievement award looking backward at his past. It was a highly strategic endorsement of his open source philosophy for the future.
This raises an incredibly important point about current geopolitics. France and Europe more broadly simply do not have the massive venture capital that the United States and China have to pour into artificial intelligence.
They just don't have the cash.
Right. So if AI remains a closed, proprietary system locked inside the servers of a few trillion-dollar tech monopolies, Europe is locked out. They lose their digital sovereignty entirely.
But if the most powerful AI models are open source, that levels the global playing field overnight.
Exactly. France is explicitly using open source AI as a strategy for national survival in the tech race. They are actively backing nonprofit research labs like QTI and aggressively supporting domestic startups like Mistral, which are built entirely on the principles of open models.
It's political.
Highly political. For the French government, LeCun's philosophy of open source perfectly mirrors the core values of the French Republic, equality and fraternity, literally translated into source code. If the knowledge is open, a nation doesn't have to be the richest to remain fiercely competitive.
It is wild how a debate over who gets cited for a Turing Award spirals directly into the national defense strategy of a G7 nation.
It escalates quickly, yeah.
Yeah.
But it all comes back to the core question that triggered this entire deep dive.
Right. Who owns a discovery? Because we've explored three very distinct answers today. Jürgen Schmidhuber says the discovery belongs to the very first person to write the mathematical idea down on paper, even if they are in the Soviet Union in 1965 with no way to build it.
Right.
But the Global Consensus and the Turing Committee, they said the discovery belongs to the people who endure the academic winters, do the grueling, backbreaking labor, and finally make the machine work in the real world.
And then there is Jan LeCun's answer. He says the discovery belongs to absolutely no one. It shouldn't be trapped in a corporate patent, and it shouldn't be hoarded for academic popularity. It should be an open public record for all of humanity to pull from and build upon.
That philosophy sounds beautiful. It really does. But it leaves us with a final, highly unresolved question to consider. LeCun won his Turing Award, and he accepted his medal from the French president, all while championing this completely open, borderless world. But he works as the chief AI scientist for one of the largest Silicon Valley mega corporations on the planet.
Yeah, and the text heavily foreshadows a very serious tension on the horizon regarding that relationship.
Because if LeCun truly believes that closing off AI research is a scientific dead end, what happens when the very corporation funding his work decides that open source is no longer profitable? Like, what happens when it's time to start changing the locks? How long can a champion of the open world survive inside a walled garden?
It's a great question. The Turing Award ceremony in San Francisco was basically a victory lap for surviving the past. But the real test of who controls the future of artificial intelligence is just beginning.
It makes you reconsider everything. We started by looking at that brilliant, clean snapshot of the Turing Award Stage 3 Man, $1 million, the recognized fathers of AI. But when you look closer, the waters are deeply muddy with decades of forgotten names, bitter academic rivalries, and a looming geopolitical battle over whether the knowledge of the future will be kept behind closed corporate doors or left out in the open for anyone brave enough to build a sand yacht and see how fast it can go. Something to think about as you navigate our newly automated world.